Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was recorded on Friday, June 21st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's decisions yesterday in American Express v. Italian Colors Restaurant, dealing with arbitrations and class actions, and USAID versus OSI, concerning government and speech. My name is Christian Corgan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. And also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts to each discuss one of the cases I mentioned earlier. Our first expert is Mr. Andrew J. Pincus to discuss the American Express case, who is a partner at Mayer Brown and focuses his appellate practice on briefing and arguing cases in the Supreme Court of the United States and in federal and state appellate courts, as well as developing legal arguments in court. He has argued 23 cases in the Supreme Court of the United States. Our other expert is Mr. Eric Jaffe, who is also an appellate litigator with a practice covering a wide variety of legal issues in both state and federal courts of appeals. A substantial portion of Mr. Jaffe's practice focuses on constitutional issues and litigation in the United States Supreme Court, and today he'll be discussing the USAID case. A more complete bio for both speakers was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. To discuss the American Express case, I'll now turn the floor over to Mr. Pincus.
Thanks very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for providing this forum to discuss two, I think, quite important decisions as we are in the countdown to the end of this term. American Express, to me, and I think to a lot of people, is a very exciting decision in the long battle to establish the enforceability of arbitration systems that increase access to justice for consumers and reduce transaction costs, especially legal fees, of both plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers. The issue in American Express really follows on the court's decision 2 years ago in the AT&T Mobility against Concepcion case. The issue in Concepcion was whether California could condition the enforceability of an arbitration agreement on the availability of class procedures, either in arbitration or in court. California said, we're happy to enforce your arbitration clause, but you must provide class procedures, even if the arbitration clause expressly provides that arbitration had to be conducted on a bilateral basis, in other words, individual claims only, and barred class procedures. And what the court said in Concepcion is that California couldn't do that, and that the state law rule that purported to do that was preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act, which the court said provides for embodies bilateral arbitration as something that's protected against state interference and therefore precluded California's legal rule. In the wake of Concepcion, plaintiff lawyers seeking to invalidate arbitration clauses said, well, Concepcion applies only to when the claim at issue arises under state law. It doesn't apply when the claim at issue arises under federal law. They argued that the Supreme Court had endorsed what they called an effective vindication doctrine, which required that federal rights be able to be vindicated effectively in arbitration, and that that required a fact-specific, very intensive inquiry about all the procedures provided for under the arbitration agreement to see whether that was true, and if the plaintiff could show that the arbitration agreement didn't allow for effective vindication under this quite detailed and narrow standard, then the arbitration clause couldn't be enforced. In American Express, that issue was framed, and the court squarely rejected the plaintiff's argument and said and held that Concepcion's rule that arbitration agreements that provided for individualized arbitration and not for class procedures were just as enforceable with respect to federal claims as they are with respect to state claims. Let me give a little bit of background on the American Express case. This was an antitrust class action brought by American Express merchants against American Express, claiming that American Express's policy that required merchants who took one American Express card to honor all cards violated the antitrust laws as a tying agreement. The merchants, in their contracts with American Express, had signed an arbitration agreement, and that arbitration agreement provided that arbitration would be conducted on an individualized, on a bilateral basis, and that class procedures were impermissible. The plaintiffs argued that because the amounts at issue in some of the plaintiffs' claims were too small to support the attorney's fees and the expert costs especially that were necessary to prove the case, that showed that a class action was required and that the arbitration agreement was unenforceable because it precluded class procedures and therefore did not allow the effective vindication of the federal right conferred by the antitrust laws. The Supreme Court, the Second Circuit, agreed with that argument, and the Supreme Court reversed by a vote of 5-3, with Justice Scalia writing the majority opinion, Justice Kagan writing the dissenting opinion for three justices, because Justice Sotomayor had sat on a prior version incarnation of this case in the Second Circuit and therefore was recused. Justice Scalia started his analysis by pointing to the fundamental principle long established in the court's decisions that the Federal Arbitration Act requires that courts must rigorously enforce, as he said, arbitration agreements according to their terms, and that when a federal claim is at issue, that mandate has to be applied unless it has been overridden by a contrary congressional command. And that test is a very rigorous one. The court has used the very same standard in examining whether Congress has put federal claims off limits to arbitration, and it has never found that test satisfied. So the inquiry that the court framed was there a contrary congressional command that said an arbitration clause that precludes class procedures can't be enforced? The first place it looked for that was in the antitrust laws. And the court said there is nothing in the antitrust laws that precludes a waiver of class procedures. In fact, as the court noted, the antitrust laws predated the adoption of class procedures, so it would be quite remarkable to find that the antitrust laws embodied some requirement that class procedures be made available. Next, the court looked at Rule 23 of the Rules of Civil Procedure to see whether that embodied the requisite contrary command. But as the court observed, the rules of civil procedure, the effect of those rules is limited by the Rules Enabling Act, which says that the rules can't abridge a substantive right. And the court said if the rules were construed to embody some entitlement to class procedures, that would likely go beyond the power of the courts to promulgate such a rule. In any event, the court said, the rule doesn't embody any requirement that class procedures be made available. It simply specifies how class actions can be established in court. Then the court turned to the principal argument advanced by the plaintiffs, which is there a judge-made exception to the Federal Arbitration Act that says arbitration acts can be invalidated whenever there's a showing that they prevent the effective vindication of a federal right? And the court said, we don't find that in our decisions. The most that the court's decisions establish is, first of all, that a party can't be required to waive the right to assert a federal claim at all, but that wasn't the case here. And perhaps they also might preclude filing fees and administrative fees unique to arbitration that made access to the arbitral forum as a practical matter, impossible. But the court said it was very different to argue, as the plaintiffs did here, that the fact that a claim is not worth the expense involved in proving the remedy is itself sufficient to meet this effective vindication standard. As the court pointed out, class actions weren't available for years and years and years before the adoption of the Rule 23 procedure in the 1960s, and no one would claim that before the adoption of Rule 23, federal law was universally ineffective to vindicate federal rights. So it was hard to argue that upon the adoption of the Rule 23, that situation magically changed. The court concluded its analysis by saying, truth to tell, the ruling in AT&T Mobility against Concepcion really resolved the issue because there the court invalidated, as I discussed earlier, a state law rule that conditioned the enforcement of an arbitration clause on the availability of class procedures, and the court said that that switch from bilateral to class arbitration was fundamentally incompatible with the Federal Arbitration Act and could not be forced on parties as a condition to enforcing an arbitration agreement. So the court was quite clear in saying there is no such test, and these arbitration clauses are enforceable. Justice Thomas concurred in the opinion. He joined the court's opinion, but concurred to say that in addition, he thought that the plaintiff's argument was squarely incompatible with the statutory text. The dissent, written by Justice Kagan, as I mentioned earlier, agreed that there was a generally applicable effective vindication standard and that American Express's arbitration agreement, because it precluded class procedures, did not permit the effective vindication of the antitrust claim that the plaintiffs were asserting. Significantly, and I think very significantly, for the policy analysis of this decision, the dissent did not say that class procedures have to be available in order for a claim to be effectively vindicated. Justice Kagan specifically said that other options, such as allowing plaintiffs to file individual claims but to share a common lawyer and a common expert and therefore share the costs and spread them over multiple claims, could well be sufficient. That a provision in the arbitration agreement providing for cost shifting of expert claims to a defendant in the event that the plaintiff was successful could also be sufficient. She concluded that none of those things were present in this case and that therefore the American Express Clause did not allow the effective vindication of this claim. Interestingly, there was a little bit of a factual dispute between the majority and the dissent on that point because American Express in the Supreme Court, both in its brief and in its oral argument, had said expressly that it viewed its clause as permitting the very kind of cost sharing among individual claimants that Justice Kagan said was sufficient to meet the statutory standard. But she refused to acknowledge that concession in the court and basically took the case as if that concession had not been made. Justice Scalia, in the majority opinion, made the point that she was just wrong about the facts as they appeared before the Supreme Court. So what are the legal implications of this decision? What does it mean? I think, first of all, what does it mean in terms of the enforceability of arbitration clauses in court? And there, the decision really clears away this last remaining objection that had been advanced forcefully by plaintiff's lawyers to the enforcement of arbitration clauses with class waivers. It's going to be very, very hard for a plaintiff to argue to a court that an arbitration clause should not be enforced simply because it contains a waiver of class procedures and requires individual procedures. Of course, that doesn't mean that the plaintiff's bar is going to end its effort to try to invalidate arbitration agreements. What I think is likely is that it will switch its focus to other issues. Even before the Amex decision, simply as a result of the decision in Concepcion, the plaintiff's bar had begun to focus on contract formation, saying that the person who was the plaintiff, either the consumer or the employee, really hadn't agreed to the arbitration agreement, that the company's procedures really didn't provide enough clarity about the assent to the arbitration agreement, and that that was a reason why the agreement should not be enforced. In addition, plaintiffs are beginning to focus as they did years ago, on challenges under general state unconscionability provisions, claiming that, for example, the method of selecting the arbitrator or the amount of the fees or the location of the arbitration somehow violates unconscionability laws. I think clearly, and the Supreme Court said in both Concepcion and a subsequent decision in Marmet Healthcare Centers, generally applicable unconscionability rules can apply to arbitration clauses. But I think what we have to be on the lookout for are efforts to apply not general unconscionability rules, but special unconscionability rules that target only on arbitration clauses. And my guess is there's going to be an effort to convince especially state courts to do just that, that parties seeking to enforce arbitration are going to have to be on the lookout for. Finally, my guess is that we're going to see additional focus by the plaintiffs bar and its allies on efforts both in Congress and before federal regulatory agencies to change the rules governing arbitration clause. In Congress, there's long been a bill called the Arbitration Fairness Act that essentially would eliminate the applicability of the Federal Arbitration Act to consumer and employment contracts. My guess is we'll see increased attempts to pass that, although given the political alignment of Congress, I think that will be quite an uphill battle. Probably more focus will be on getting federal regulatory agencies to act. And there, the NLRB last year issued a decision in a case called D.R. Horton that basically said it was an unfair labor practice to include in an employment agreement a class action waiver. That determination has been invoked in a lot of cases around the country in an attempt to invalidate arbitration clauses and almost universally rejected. But the decision itself is now before the Fifth Circuit on a petition for review. That case has been argued, and we'll see when it's decided. The other places where there's a lot of activity is before the SEC to try and get adoption of a rule prohibiting arbitration clauses in broker-dealer agreements between broker-dealers and their customers, and before the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which also has the statutory power to limit or regulate the use of arbitration agreements, and which right now is engaged in a study that the statute makes a predicate for any regulatory activity. Why don't I stop there and look forward to answering your questions and having a discussion about these issues.
Well, hello. This is Eric Jaffe, and I'll give you the rundown on Agency for International Development versus Alliance for Open Society International. For those of you who were not closely following this hot decision, it involves the U.S. government's programs to combat AIDS abroad. The U.S. government does this in a variety of ways, by funding drugs, by funding health care for children and families with AIDS, and among other things, and most relevant here, by trying to discourage prostitution and sex trafficking, which is a source of AIDS transmission, particularly among, you can imagine, illegal prostitutes who don't get good health care, who aren't looked out for and whatnot. And in the course of passing this program, there's a condition upon the receipt of federal funds. So federal funds go out to all kinds of nonprofit entities and other sort of quasi-governmental entities to implement these programs, to implement it by handing out the drugs, by providing the health care, and in some instances by providing education and even anti-sex trafficking or anti-prostitution education. The folks in this case are non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that do some of this work, but not all of this work. So primarily they provide health care and AIDS drugs. They don't do the anti-prostitution advocacy themselves, but as a condition for getting any money under the program, they have to sign a pledge saying that they, A, won't use any of the money to advocate prostitution. That's easy. Everyone agrees that that's okay. But B, they have to say it is our explicit policy that we oppose prostitution and sex trafficking. They have to adopt that viewpoint as their own. And while the opinion itself doesn't talk about it much, they actually are not allowed to do anything inconsistent with that statement. And those are the groups that challenge this, saying, look, you know, it's not like we're going to use your money for pro-prostitution purposes, but we don't want to have to say we're anti-prostitution because that pisses off some foreign governments. It annoys the prostitutes who we're trying to actually treat. It annoys lots of people, and it makes our job harder. And in some instances, we may not agree with you. So they challenged this as a First Amendment problem, and the upshot of it is they won by a 6-2 vote. Justice Kagan was not involved because she was still at the SG's office when this was going on, but an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor, and a dissent by Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas. But Chief Justice Roberts held that the condition on funding was an unconstitutional condition in that it compelled the expression of a viewpoint that was not sufficiently tied to the program such that it was a limitation on the program itself, but in fact it was a limitation on the recipient of federal funds rather than on what the recipient could do with federal funds. And as you go through the opinion, the trouble with this area of the law has always been that the cases are terribly inconsistent historically and have no cogent theory. So on the one hand, you have the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which says you may not condition the receipt of a federal benefit or privilege on a requirement that you give up some constitutional right or do something that would be unconstitutional to compel you to do in the first instance. So basically, you can't make people do something by bribing, by withholding benefits that you couldn't make them do by forcing them to do it. It's not a very controversial doctrine historically, but in fact, as you apply it, it becomes more and more difficult to apply. So that's on the one side. On the other side is the notion that the federal government gets to pick and choose its programs, and it gets to pay for those that it wants to, and it doesn't have to pay for anything else. So once you're picking and choosing, then obviously you can limit the money to the program that you picked and not give money to something that you didn't pick. And so many programs these days are mixed activities and speech, and at the moment those programs are speech or have some speech component to them, telling you that you can't do X. We'll only give you money if you don't do X, if you don't say X. Sounds like an unconstitutional condition. And so there's a big mess in the case law, and there's cases going both ways, and it's very inconsistent. And at the end of the day, Chief Justice Roberts and his the five who joined him basically said the way we're going to reconcile this is by saying that you are allowed to place a speech condition on the use of federal funds. So you may not use this federal money to advocate some view that we don't like, but you may not make the receipt of federal funds conditioned on the person never expressing views you don't like, or alternatively, having to express views that you prefer that they express. So John Doe gets money to pave the street, but you can't say, I'll only give you money to pave the street if you say, go Obama. You know, some doctor gets money to vaccinate kids, but presumably you can't say, I'll only give you the money to vaccinate kids if you also say you oppose abortion. And so viewed that way, this sort of falls into that category pretty cleanly. The recipients in this case were not, in fact, the folks who were hired to convey the government's anti-prostitution message. They were doing other stuff. They were handing out AIDS drugs. They were giving health care to people who already had AIDS or what have you. They were promoting condom use, things like that. And so it's not like they would be doing something in, you know, that the government said, we're going to pay you to say X, so don't say not X. No, they were doing something somewhat tangential to it, and the government was trying to stop them from saying things in their private capacities that the government didn't like. Whereas, on the other hand, presumably, if they were the folks who were actually the government's paid spokespersons for trying to discourage prostitution, then this would be a much more direct, and it would be a programmatic definition. It would be what they were being paid to do, and so, of course, the government could say, you have to say this because that's what we're paying you to say. The dissent was, you know, the trouble with the case law being mixed is that the dissent is actually quite persuasive because given how mixed the case law is, you could write a persuasive opinion either way. So the dissent points out that the government obviously gets to Well, maybe not so obviously. Obviously, to the consent, to the dissent, the government gets to be not viewpoint neutral. The government gets to have an opinion and express that opinion. We'll get back to that in a minute because I think that's where the dissent goes off the rails. But in any event, this is a standard Scalia view for many, many cases where he thinks the government can pick and choose among viewpoints. It does all the time. It adopts highway funds instead of, you know, agricultural funds, or it adopts one military program versus another, or it adopts Obamacare as opposed to funding the Defense Department. Whatever you think the ideological choices are, the government gets to have an opinion. And he makes the very persuasive argument that, you know, look, no one says that we would have to use Hamas to distribute U.S. aid funds, even if they were really efficient at it. The fact that they say things we don't like and don't like the U.S. government is more than enough reason to not have to give Hamas money to hand out U.S. aid funds. And even if Hamas was a U.S. citizens group, presumably the answer is the same. And he has a compelling point there, I have to say. At the end of the day, however, what he comes down to saying is, look, whenever the speech condition is relevant, so we have a program, we believe X, we believe prostitution is bad, so it's okay for us to only give money to people who likewise believe prostitution is bad. That's the condition, and they have to say they believe it and act accordingly. That sort of becomes circular, because then any program you have that has a speech condition, well, the speech condition sort of defines the purpose of the program. So I'm going to go out and give food to folks, but I'm only going to give food to folks who believe in women's rights. Or I'm only going to give food to folks who believe in the Christian God. Or I'm only going to give food to folks who agree with X. Well, all of a sudden, those ideological conditions are, in fact, part of the purpose of the program. Much like here, we're only going to give out AIDS using groups that agree prostitution is bad. There's a question-begging quality to it, where Scalia says the First Amendment doesn't apply precisely because we've imposed a viewpoint restriction, which means it's now our viewpoint. This is the problem with government speech. It was Scalia's position they took in LMA versus Johans a number of years ago on the beef that's what's for dinner cases, where he thinks that the moment the government takes a viewpoint as its own and decides this is the viewpoint we want to advocate, it's government speech, and any money they spend, they can condition on you agreeing with that government speech because it's just part of the program. So there's my little rant on why the dissent is weird, though it's weird only because earlier precedent is wrong, not because they don't have a good point given the way the precedent is. So what do we make of all this? I guess the short answer is, the majority, while not willing to disavow the government speech doctrine in general and sort of the implications of the government speech doctrine, is similarly unwilling to take it to its full and logical conclusion, which would effectively destroy the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. Scalia, on the other hand, seems rather willing to take the government speech doctrine to its full and logical conclusion, effectively destroy the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, or at least make it so trivial that you would almost never see it actually win. But he's not quite willing to say that. And so you have two opinions, neither of which are really getting to the crux of the problem that is making it so hard to decide these cases and others like them, neither of which willing to take the logical extreme of their view. And for now, at least, the pragmatic answer is government can limit the use of its own funds, but if it's going to try to limit the speech of recipients in general, it has to be recipients that are much more closely involved in expressing the government's own views, much like a government spokesperson would be, or a group that we hire to promote and advocate something specifically, rather than merely folks who are peripherally attached to a program that also through other people advocated an idea. And that's a very practical answer. It's not ideologically satisfying, though I think it's the better of the two choices to leave some teeth in the unconstitutional conditions doctrine versus destroy it altogether. Obviously, from what I've said, I prefer more teeth in the doctrine than less, so the majority opinion doesn't go far enough, but I think the dissenting opinion goes too far in the other direction. So we're going to be where we were before this case, which is every new case is going to be a bit of a muddle, but at least there's going to have to be some tighter nexus between the federal funds and the thing that you want your recipient to say or not to say, and how that works with the federal program. I don't think it will have much of a long-term impact. Future cases will be sort of ambiguous and just as difficult, given that neither side has resolved the central contradiction of government speech. That's it.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. Thank you, both of you, for your two great summaries of the two opinions. And now we'll turn to our audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. If you'd like to ask a question, enter star and then the pound key. Again, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And we'll get to your question in the order in which it in the order in which you are in line. A quick programming note. I want to remind you all to visit our new Executive Branch Review Project blog at executivebranchproject.com. That's all one word, executivebranchproject.com. And again, if you do have a question on either of the cases for either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Our lines are open. Well, while we're waiting for our first question, I'll sort of take the moderator's prerogative here and start off by throwing one to Mr. Pincus. You know, Mr. Pincus, you argued the Concepcion case at the Supreme Court, actually, correct?
Yes, I did.
With your familiarity with that case, was the court's breakdown in that in the American Express decision, was it somewhat predictable? I mean, is this what you had thought that the breakdown would be?
Well, I guess I had hopes that because the argument that in some ways the argument that was being made by the plaintiffs here was even more disturbing in terms of the ability for parties to arbitration agreements to enforce them. So I had some hope that perhaps some justices would find it beyond the pale who had dissented in Concepcion. I mean, here. As Justice Scalia talks about at the end of his decision for the opinion for the court, the plaintiff's argument really requires a sort of a mini assessment of how the merits of a claim are going to be tried in order to decide whether or not the arbitration clause can be enforced, which is exactly the opposite of what the Federal Arbitration Act was supposed to provide for, which is quick and expeditious enforcement of arbitration agreements in order to promote the use of arbitration. But unfortunately, that didn't seem to be the case.
Great, thank
so
you.
We ended
well, our
up.
Lines are open. Again, if you have a question, press star and then the pound key on either the American Express case or the U.S. Agency for International Development case. We have two experts on the line to answer your questions. Mr. Jaffe, I'll go ahead and throw one out to you as well. You mentioned sort of the line of cases that had led Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, the precedent that had sort of led them there. Do you want to give a little bit more of the history and discuss sort of that lineage of cases?
Sure. I mean, there are cases out there that basically say, even though you have the right to say X, Y, and Z, the government doesn't have to subsidize X, Y, and Z. It can choose to only subsidize X. And so the example that most commonly comes up, there's two examples. One is a case involving basically birth control, where the government said, we want to subsidize family planning activities, but not abortion activities. And so that was upheld. That limitation on the use of federal funds was upheld to say, look, the government just wants to encourage birth control and other forms of family planning, but not abortion. It doesn't have to encourage abortion, and excluding abortion from its funding is not a violation of the First Amendment. There was another case that involved nonprofit status, where the government granted tax-exempt status to folks who spoke on some educational activities, but not for lobbying activities. So it chose not to subsidize lobbying, while it chose to, you know, through a tax exemption, to tax-free status, to subsidize non-lobbying speech activity. And once again, those cases held, the government doesn't have to pay for all speech, and the fact that it pays for some but not others doesn't mean that it's violating the First Amendment. I have to say in candor that those cases have very little theory behind them, and very little First Amendment cogency behind them. The notion that the government can pick and choose what speech it likes and what speech it doesn't, and use federal dollars, tax dollars, coerced money, to pay for some ideas but not others, is doubtful. But the cases all uniformly say that at this point, and there's no likelihood that the Supreme Court's going to change its mind on that. It's just wrong about that. If tomorrow the government decided, we're going to subsidize Democrats but not Republicans. So anybody who's a registered Democrat is going to be tax-exempt for all their speech activities, but anybody who's Republican is not going to be tax-exempt for all their speech activities. No one on the planet thinks that that doesn't violate the First Amendment, though no one except perhaps Justice Scalia. He might think it violates something else, but maybe not the First Amendment. But the short answer is that's a paradigmatic example of government spending power violating the First Amendment. And there's very little way to distinguish these cases that I just described from that hypothetical. So that's where Scalia gets his point. He's right that that's what the cases say. The difficulty is that those cases fail to deal with the notion that while the government gets to take sides in terms of the policies it adopts and implements, i.e. the things it does, it may not be so free in terms of its speech. It doesn't distinguish speech from other forms of conduct, and hence it has a difficulty in terms of First Amendment theory. And that's really where the central dilemma of this whole line of cases is, because it's hard to have an unconstitutional conditions doctrine and the notion that the government can selectively subsidize speech at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, we do have our first question on the line, and we apologize. We were having some trouble with our system and the question system earlier, but it seems to be working now. So again, if you do have a question, we have about 20 minutes for questions, so press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key, and we'll go to our first question now.
Yes, a question for Mr. Pincus about the Amex decision. In the decision, Justice Scalia said that the Randolph line of cases relating to invalidating an arbitration agreement where the costs unique to arbitration were prohibitive was still valid. Yet there's also a footnote in the decision where Justice Scalia says that the primary purpose of the Arbitration Act is not to ensure that arbitrations actually happen, but to enforce arbitration clauses as written. So, number one, is there a tension between those two positions? And number two, does the Randolph line apply at all to cases that are in state court and arising under state law?
Well, let me take your last question first. I think it's quite clear that the Randolph line does not apply at all to cases arising under state law. It is totally focused on vindication of federal statutory rights. That being said, state unconscionability law might provide a similar standard. For example, there are a number of state unconscionability rulings say if the cost of proceeding in arbitration, especially when you have a form contract of adhesion, so unconscionability rules apply, where the costs of proceeding in arbitration are significantly higher than they would be for proceeding in court, that may be a basis for invalidating the arbitration clause. But I think those unconscionability decisions are right. So the question is there some special federal rule that applies only to federal causes of action? And I guess it seemed to me that Justice Scalia was pretty skeptical about the Randolph line of cases, because he basically said, to the extent this rule actually exists, he said it would perhaps cover filing an administrative fee. So I think he was indicating some skepticism, and I think the skepticism was based on the fact that that line, that although there has been repeated dictum that there is this test, it's never really been applied to invalidate an arbitration agreement. It seems to me that there might be an argument that where a state's unconscionability law didn't have the effect I just described, in other words, it didn't invalidate a clause that had a greatly disproportionate charge for proceeding in arbitration, there might, and the claim arose under federal law, it might be that this federal principle would be a sort of a gap filler to substitute for what state unconscionability law would otherwise provide. But I think the decision makes quite clear that the Randolph line of dictum, which is what it really is a very, very limited effect, and I think the court was quite skeptical about it.
Great. Well, our lines are open again. So if you'd like to ask a question to either of our two experts, please press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key. Well, we don't have any other questions on the line. Do either of you have any other thoughts on your decisions? Any other interesting tidbits or lines from the cases or interesting something else you saw in the opinion that you think the audience might be interested in?
Sure. I guess I'd make one point that I think is quite interesting, because if you read the dissent, especially in American Express, there's a lot of pretty tough rhetoric there that makes it sound like the dissent is pressing a legal standard that's going to have dramatically different results in a lot of cases. But I think if you follow the dissent's analysis to its logical conclusion, that just isn't so. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier, the dissent says under the effective vindication standard as it conceptualizes it, class procedures aren't required. There are other ways that an arbitration clause could meet the effective vindication test, and one of them, the dissent says, is this cost sharing. In other words, a bunch of plaintiffs file identical claims. They're represented by the same lawyer. The same expert is used, so there's the ability to basically share these common costs over a large number of claims, and therefore to make the economic test work. And the dissent says, if that's present, that's fine. That will meet the effective vindication test. Well, in reality, I've seen a lot of arbitration clauses, and I've never seen one that precludes plaintiffs from doing that or claimants in arbitration from doing that. So if that's all that's required in order to meet the effective vindication standard, I think in practical effect, that test is going to lead to the exact same real-world results as Justice Scalia's and the majority standard, which is, in every case, the arbitration agreement is going to be enforced. So it's an interesting distinction between some rhetoric that seems to indicate a dramatically different outcome, but when you parse through the dissent's analysis, maybe there's really not much difference there.
Great. Well, we do actually now have two questions on the line, so and we should have time to get to both of them, so we'll go ahead with our next question.
Thank you. A question for both panelists, and I'm going to show my bias with the question. Do you think there's any chance that Congress will moderate the anti-consumerist effects of the Arbitration Act? It seems that major corporations use it routinely to screw consumers in consumer contracts. Any hope that Congress will fix this? Thank you.
I'll chime in. While it wasn't my case to discuss today, I do follow it, and my answer is no. I don't think there's any chance. I don't think there's a snowball chance in hell it's going to happen. This act has been around for ages, and every time it gets to the Supreme Court, the consumer loses. I mean, go look at these cases. They routinely lose because they meant what they said, and the Supreme Court has shown itself willing to enforce it. And particularly now, I mean, you had a Congress that had a lot better chance of getting something passed before than now. I don't think this administration can get anything passed that would basically flip, you know, decades worth of Federal Arbitration Act jurisprudence. So, I mean, maybe my politics prognostication is not great, but this is sort of nothing new here. They've been trying to get around this over and over and over again. And the whole reason they passed the act is because people hated arbitration, precisely because they thought it was anti-consumer. And Congress thought otherwise, and no one's had the votes to change that yet. And I don't think they're going to get them.
Yeah, and this is Andy Pincus, and I agree with that on the politics, but I disagree with the premise of the question. I think it's quite clear that while arbitration hurts lawyers, both plaintiffs and defense lawyers, because they can't charge as much as they can when they're either prosecuting or defending big class actions, I think it's actually great for consumers. You know, in the real world, most injuries that people suffer are neither classable, because they're individualized, and they aren't sufficient to attract the services of a lawyer, because they're probably under about $50,000, which is what most people say is the minimum for a contingent fee lawyer to take on a case. So without arbitration, those people are left to navigate a very difficult legal system and a very overcrowded legal system that really is not going to provide them with any justice. And that's especially true of small claims courts, which are unbelievably inefficient and overcrowded and require people who in the real world can't take lots of time off of work to take lots of time off of work if they really want to pursue a claim. So those people aren't going to get any justice in court. An arbitration system, and arbitration systems that are fair, and the data is overwhelming that arbitration systems such as those administered by the American Arbitration Association are fair, provide those people with their only realistic opportunity for justice. So you've got a greatly enhanced access to a neutral decision maker to resolve your claim for this lion's share of the kinds of claims that consumers suffer. And the question is the fact that you can't bring a class action a reason to say to all those people, well, too bad for you. We're gonna keep you in a position where you can't get justice. And to me, the answer is that doesn't make any sense. First of all, for the reasons we've just been talking about, the ability to share costs, even small claims that are suffered by multiple individuals can be remedied in arbitration. And frankly, I think no one has to look too hard at the class action system to say it's not really providing justice for much of anybody, except for large legal fees, as I say. But any study of the benefits that go to actual class members, and that's hard to do because, not surprisingly, the claims process is cloaked in secrecy, but the few claims results that have been revealed show claims of 1% or thereabouts in terms of the members of the class that actually get money. So to me, this is a great trade-off for consumers, especially in a world where arbitration can be made accessible over the Internet and very consumer-friendly as it is.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that I thought the premise was right, other than in the sense that there will certainly be outlier cases, or there will be some cases in which the litigant might well be better off with some big, nasty federal statute that's intimidating and imposing and that has punies and this and that and all kinds of horrible things to it that you can use to coerce a settlement. So in those outlier cases, the consumer nominally loses. But I agree with everything Mr. Pincus said about class actions are largely a scam for lawyers. The ones that I've been involved in litigating on appeal just are often grotesque embarrassments of justice. They're not that at all. They're coercive. They're often not based on good legal arguments, and the consumer at the end of the day doesn't get much out of it. So I sort of agree that from a systemic point of view, arbitration is a much more likely mechanism to get, you know, the right amount of dollars to the right people at a reasonable transaction cost.
Great. This is Christian Corgan again. Looks like we have one more question on the line with about 8 minutes to go. So we may have time after that for one more question. So if you have a question, please press star and then the pound key, and we'll go to our next caller.
Hi, I was just wondering if there is any relationship or implication of the language on the speech decision and speech that the government requires, such as oath of office or anything like that.
Well, that's sort of an interesting, you know, Scalia makes this point, obviously, that it's okay to compel affirmation of belief. And I suppose my answer is onefold, which is the Constitution has that oath of office contained in it. And so to whatever extent there is a theoretical inconsistency between affirmations of belief and the First Amendment, you have to reconcile them because they're both there. But I think we resolved this a long time ago that you can't make school children say the Pledge of Allegiance, right? They get to sit down and not say it. So, yes, that's another oath. It's an oath of allegiance. You can't coerce that out of people not placed in a unique position of trust. And, you know, I suppose what you can do in some instances is say, I promise, I pledge not to spend the money on things that I promise not to spend the money on. Well, but that's not really an affirmation of belief. It's not saying I believe in the Constitution. And in some sense, it's not even clear to me that the oath of office says you believe in the Constitution. You promise to uphold it. You don't say one way or the other what you actually believe. One would hope that you believe it. Otherwise, we might be a little skeptical. But at the end of the day, I think we would allow skeptics who think the Constitution ought to be amended to nonetheless be appointed into positions where they are obliged with enforcing it as written until it does get amended. So, you know, in terms of that, I don't think there's really quite as much inconsistency between the oath of office and this notion, this non-affirmation notion that the majority has. But Scalia makes a fair point that there are some instances that the Constitution sanctions where we demand, hopefully, that you say you'll do what society agrees you ought to do. And even if we couch that as an affirmation of a belief, saying that you believe in the single foundational and most fundamental aspect of our law is a whole pile different than saying you believe in the current policy positions of the regime that will get voted out in 3 years, right? I mean, that is the line between fundamental and foundational constitutional views versus political views that blow in the wind and allowing a regime to entrench itself. To say that we allow the Constitution to entrench itself is a little different than saying we allow the current Republican or Democratic president to entrench themselves and their policies. So I view them as a sort of a difference in kind, even if the at the end of the day theoretical question is similar. There's still a category difference between oaths to uphold the Constitution and oaths to uphold the flavor of the month.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Christian Corrigan again. We're getting down to our last few minutes of the call. So to conclude, I just want to ask both of our experts to give a minute or so, just sort of summarizing their thoughts and give any concluding ideas and opinions sort of going forward. So we'll start with you, Mr. Pincus.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I think what's important here is that there's been a running battle about the enforceability of arbitration agreements, and I think what the Supreme Court has done in this decision is to deal with one of the principal arguments that's being raised by those people who don't like arbitration or are trying to block the enforcement of arbitration clauses, and to say those arguments don't work. So I think what's going to happen is, as a policy matter, that's going to make arbitration agreements more clearly enforceable. That's going to lead, I think, to more effective arbitration systems, and as I said before, I think that's great for consumers because I think fair arbitration is gives you much more access to justice in the real world than the theoretical but impractical opportunities that the litigation system provides.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jaffe?
I guess the one thing I'd close with is to say, look, this area of the law has a serious intrinsic tension in it, and to think about it going forward, think about the examples, these two examples, should we have to give foreign aid to Hamas, who has openly advocates the destruction, you know, the U.S. government's terrible, it's awful, we should get the heck out of the Middle East. Should we have to distribute money through them? And I think most people would say no. Versus, should we be able to limit federal funds under Obamacare to people who supported Obamacare and to those hospitals that came out in favor of it? Or to Democrats, just to Democrats in general, should we be able to do that? And most people would say, no, we shouldn't be able to do that, but no, we shouldn't have to give to Hamas either. And it's those two sort of hypotheticals that I think are not all that different at the end of the day. And so to resolve that contradiction in our intuitions is extremely hard. And the answer ultimately lies a little further back in First Amendment jurisprudence on why it is that the government gets to advocate ideas at all as opposed to simply implement ideas. You get to build the road. You don't get to propagandize as to why we need the road. And if you think of government speech as government propaganda, maybe you think of it in a different way than if it's just government speech taking a viewpoint, which sounds so innocuous. And I don't know what the answer at the end of the day is. I have my own preferences, obviously, but I recognize that there is a huge dilemma there and that in some instances, government propaganda and government speech, especially in the international arena, probably is permissible because it's something that you just need to do. So think about that when you're figuring out your own answer, but I think you're going to see more cases like this in the future, and I think you're not going to find any greater coherence in their resolution one way or the other.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both of our experts today, Eric Jaffe and Andrew Pincus. We very much appreciate them joining us to report on these two important decisions. Also, thank you to our audience for taking the time out of your day to join us. A quick reminder that we always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And another reminder to please check out our practice group Executive Branch Review Project blog at executivebranchproject.com. Until the next time, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.